These days, we're treated to the turmoil in the Middle East with Islam caught in the crosswinds of the modern era. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. The most prominent images that Americans see are those of jihadist organizations like the Islamic State or such countries as the Islamic Republic of Iran. During his 2016 campaign, we heard the president urging a ban on immigrants from Muslim countries. There is no doubt that Islam, particularly in the Middle East, is undergoing a struggle with the world of the 21st century, sometimes violently. In our studio this morning is Professor Mukhtar Khan. He is with the Political Science Department at the University of Delaware, also written a new book called Islam and Good Governance, a Political Philosophy of Isfahan. It looks at how Islam may have gone astray in developing such things as the Islamic State and a rich history that points to an alternative. And welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me, Don.
So before we actually get into the heart of it, let's get some definitions of some terms here. Yeah. So describe what is the Quran?
So the Quran is the text, the canonical text on which Islamic faith is based. Muslims believe that the entire text is the literal word of God itself. It revealed to Prophet Muhammad, sometimes directly, sometimes through angel Gabriel. So Gabriel would come. In the initial days, Gabriel would come and recite the verse to Muhammad in Arabic and make sure that Muhammad had memorized it. Sometimes the revelations came directly as an inspiration, and other times they came through, most of the times through Archangel Gabriel. It took about 23 years for the Quran to be revealed, and Muslims use the Quran to recite prayers. And it is also a source of values, and it explains why we are, who we are, what human relations should be with God. There are about 6,300 verses, and most scholars think that 10% of the Quran is do's and don'ts, rules, and 90% of it is about metaphysics, about spirituality, about the nature of God. God reveals a lot about himself in the Quran, the names of God, his attributes, his qualities, and the nature of the world are all revealed in the Quran. So when we talk about Islamic State, for example, people use those 10% verses, which are do's and don'ts, as Islamic law and try to reduce Islam to just that. They are called verses of ahkam or instruction. And so sometimes I think when people become very politicized and Islam is politicized, and then it is just reduced to the law, which is 10% of the Quran. So in my book, I look at various other verses and other aspects of Quran in order to suggest that there is more to Islam than just Islamic law.
Before we add, also, what is the hadith?
Hadiths are traditions. There are at the most 70,000 traditions, of which Muslims consider about 4,000 to 5,000 as authentic. The rest are various degrees of authenticity. Some may be fabricated, some may be weak. So hadiths are essentially what the Prophet said, what the Prophet did, and what the Prophet saw and did not forbid or forbid. So if the Prophet saw you playing soccer and said, don't play soccer, that becomes a hadith. If the Prophet saw you playing soccer and didn't say anything, that also becomes a hadith. It means he approves of you doing that. And then, of course, some of his actions, like having a beard, of the way he washed, every time he entered a place, he put his right foot forward. These are all his precedents, and these are reported in hadith, and Muslims consider it as part of the faith. So the Quran and hadith, essentially traditions of the Prophet and divine revelations, are the two fundamental sources of Islam.
So, and then how does Sharia law then fit into all of that?
Well, Sharia law, it depends on how you define Sharia law. Sometimes people define, in the simplest terms, when you ask a scholar of Sharia law, he says that Sharia law is essentially Islamic law. This is what God wants you to do. So the primary source is the Quran. So the Quran says fast in the month of Ramadan. And so it's a Sharia law that you fast in the month of Ramadan. What do you do when you break your fast? Some of it is in the Quran, some are not. But then someone would have asked that question of the Prophet, and peace be upon him, and he would have answered that question. So we get the legal ruling now from the Hadith. Can Muslims play chess? There's nothing in the Quran, but the Prophet said chess is very obsessive and kind of said it could distract you from other things, including God, so maybe don't play chess. So that is how Sharia law is. But But there are very limited things that the Quran and the Hadith directly address. And then the rest of it is essentially opinions of medieval scholars who developed Islamic jurisprudence, who developed laws about how to derive laws. All of that is something that evolved after the after really 150 years of Muhammad Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam's passing away. So in that sense, Islamic law today, when we say what is Sharia, it is Islamic jurisprudence, Islamic rulings, Islamic sources, opinions of hundreds of scholars that have lived and passed, different divisions and sects that have emerged in Islam over a period of time. Some of those sects have emerged based on different juristic interpretations of the law.
So one of the things that struck me, and it's something before, and that is that Islam is struggling with how to deal with the modern era. It's in the 20th century, but also the 21st century. And the question about why isn't it as competitive as, say, for instance, the West, is that an accurate way to look at this revival, as it were, of Islam? Because when I look at, for instance, the 20th century, one of the big breaks is obviously Pan-Arabism, which occurred, which was thought to be an answer, right, to the colonial period. That obviously has now disappeared. Is that one of the primary struggles, do you think?
Well, in your question, you use Islam as a substitute for not just the religion of Islam, but also what we call our civilization of area. So mm-hmm. you're also using it for a region.
Right.
So Islam is both a religion like Christianity and also a civilization like Christendom. When you use the word Christianity, we often make this distinction. We say Christianity and the Christian world or Christendom. But often that distinction is not made. When you say Islam versus the West, I mean, it's a religion versus a direction, right? So we are talking about it. So when we talk about the challenges of the Muslim world, I prefer that term better, faces, then yes, some of it is because of underdevelopment, bad governance in the Muslim world, lack of security. It's one of the regions right now which has the most conflicts. You can see the Yemen war, potentially an Iran war, Iraq mess, Syria, and so on. This is a place which is generating the largest number of refugees at the moment. So yes, the Muslim world is suffering from many issues of security and politics, but there's also a enduring backwardness in terms of scientific development, in terms of institutional developments. Even nations are not fully developed, and so nation building is a big challenge in the Muslim world. And there have been various ways to try and explain why this underdevelopment exists.
Do you have some sense about why that
is? Some people in the West have tried to blame it on Islam and said because Muslims have not reformed Islam and religion holds them back. And the same argument was made in the past about Catholics and is still used to explain the relative underdevelopment of southern countries in both Europe and in the Americas. But among Muslims, there have been broadly three responses. There are traditionalists who believe that the reason why the Muslims have lost their past glory and power is because they have abandoned Islam. So there is a call to return to Islam, and so Islamic revivalism, because if you look at the Arab world before Islam, it was in a state of ignorance, underdeveloped, and tribal conflict. And once they embraced Islam, they became a great empire. So Islam brought glory to them once they abandoned the ways of Islam. So there are two or three types of movements, those who are puritanical, who just want Muslims to practice Islam in a ritualistic way. And then there are Islamists who want to bring back Islam in a political sense and say that we can only develop, we can only grow, we can only become powerful if we create Islamic states. And then there are those who say, no, one of the reasons why Muslims have become very backward is because of abandonment of science. And you can see what happened to the Muslim world a little bit in the U.S. as we decide not to do scientific research, as we believe in creationism as opposed to evolution. So this abandonment of science will often translate directly into relative backwardness. Other societies develop more powerful weapons, and so you fall behind, and your resources are not yours anymore. So that remains a challenge. But the critical thing is, the thing that I'm trying to address in my book is, basically I'm answering two questions that two civilizations have posed. One, that primarily coming from West and other non-Muslim parts of the world, as to, if ISIS and Al-Qaeda are not Islam, then what is Islam? If this is not Islam, then what is Islam? So in my book, I try to talk about that there are many different ways of thinking of Islam and its role in the public sphere. Historically, Muslims have had different ways of thinking about it, and one way of thinking about it is what the Salafi jihadis portray, which is ISIS and Al-Qaeda. But traditional Islam has never been like that. Muslims have been mystical. Muslims have made beautiful things, from Taj Mahal to Blue Mosque. Aesthetics is a part of Islam. Compassion and mercy is a part of Islam. God himself says that I have sent Muhammad as nothing but mercy to all people, which would mean Muslims and non-Muslims. Muslims have interpreted that to understand that mercy not just to human beings, but also to animals and to the environment, so to all worlds, essentially. And the second thing is that there is a demand for Islam in the public sphere. Muslims want Islam to play a role in the political arena. And because the only developed answer so far is to impose Islamic law through the creation of an Islamic state, I'm trying to answer them and say, no, you can bring Islam into the public sphere, but there is an alternative way. There is a beautiful way of doing that. A political enterprise which is premised on aesthetics of values. And that is where Ihsan comes in. Ihsan means to do things beautifully. And the Prophet Muhammad said that God commanded Muslims to do whatever you do beautifully. So my question is, if we engage in politics, what will be the beautiful form of politics? And so for Muslims to engage in politics is not just to impose Islamic law on others or anybody else, but to develop institutions which will create an environment where society will become critical, where you will look at more of how can I improve myself rather than how can I force you to do this or that. Secondly, how can we be compassionate and merciful in our societies? How to be forgiving of each other? The third thing is to get away from identity politics. Identity politics is all about what can I do for myself? Whereas I'm trying to say being a good Muslim means what can I do for you rather than what can you do for myself? So that is the trend. And I lean very heavily on the Sufi tradition to provide an alternative way of thinking about both an Islamic state and an Islamic society. And so there are some technical aspects, like I talk about how Muslims can move from thinking just of national security to thinking about national virtue. We should start talking about what is our national virtue? What are we as, like, for example, today we are talking about defending America's national security from all kinds of threats, from China, from Russia, from Iran, from North Korea, from Mexico, from Guatemala. That's all we are obsessed about. But as a society, we are not talking about who are we as a nation when it comes to values. What is our national virtue? Have you ever heard any politician talk about national virtue? And I think that one of the things that we need to do as a society, as Muslims also, and anybody else, is to talk about what is our national virtue. And from a very specific perspective, Muslims have talked about shura as part of democracy in Islam, which is you develop rules through consultation. So I'm arguing that we should apply shura to also understand what is divine law. So it's not just revealed law. You see, many things claim that they are Islamic. For example, Pakistan says it's Islamic Republic. Iran says it's Islamic Republic. Saudi Arabia says it's Islamic Republic. ISIS said it was Islamic Republic. Afghanistan claimed. They're not identical. They're not the same. So there's some so diverse these countries are, societies are, polities are, yet they say they are Islamic, which clearly shows that there are many ways of thinking about Islamic. So my argument is, why can't we envision a way of being Islamic, which is beautiful, which is what others would want to emulate? I mean, why wouldn't a true Islamic state would be that state where everybody would love to migrate to, like people want to migrate to America because things are beautiful and wonderful in that society?
Well, let me just, we're getting into that solution. One of the things that I found revealing was that this idea of Islam being an imposition of rules, right, is that has a certain amount of theological backing in terms of people relying upon certain, and you mentioned some of the theologians, I guess, for lack of a better word, that really begin to establish that idea of fusing the state to Islam and then the imposition of rules, the imposition of Islam, and comes along, it seems, that both of those, particularly the two of them, at times when the Islamic world is beginning to either find problems, either their decline in terms of. So describe a little bit about and those theologians, because I think that's they're important in understanding where we're where we've been.
See, there are two verses in the Quran. There are many verses, but the ones that I picked to make my case. One verse is what is called as Amr bil Ma'ruf wa Nahya anil Munkar, where God tells Muslims that you should encourage good and forbid evil. So, encouraging what is good and forbidding what is evil. So how do you define what is good and what is evil? So Islamic jurists and theologians ended up by saying what the Sharia demands is good, what the Sharia forbids is bad. So the good was defined in legalistic term. What is legal is good, what is illegal is bad. And so in order to, as the Quran says, encourage good, forbid evil, we need to make people adhere to Islamic law, which is good, and forbid them from violating Islamic law, which is bad. But in order to do that, we need the mechanism of the state. So this verse itself becomes the justification for establishing an Islamic state, which will then encourage people to follow Islamic law. So the contemporary modern Islamic movements, at least in English, they use the word implementation of Islamic law, which essentially means that the state will impose Islamic law. Therefore, when Iran became an Islamic state, it imposed the chador on everybody, Muslim or non-Muslim. Even if Michelle Obama goes to Saudi Arabia, she's expected to wear a hijab because they are imposing Islamic law on everybody else within the territory. However, there are other verses in the Quran which say, La ikraha fi din, that is, there is no compulsion in faith. And there is another one which says, Inna Allaha ya'muru bil adli wal ihsan, that God has commanded all of us to do beautiful things while pursuing justice. So if justice is the end goal of Islamic law, as jurists claim, even that has to be pursued in a beautiful way. I can show you the opposite way. The way we are trying to implement our immigration laws are very ugly at the moment. It's without ihsan. And some of them are saying, no, all we are doing is implementing laws. If you don't want us to do this, ask the Congress to change the laws, right? But this, even those laws can be implemented beautifully. You don't have to take away toothpaste away from children. So these verses are ignored by those who advocate Islamic State because they're not interested in doing these things beautifully. So I'm arguing that even God has said that justice is not enough. When you pursue justice, you have to pursue it in the best possible way, which means forgiveness, compassion, mercy, so on and so forth. God has described himself as just. And Muslims believe, at least the Sufis believe, that God, before he created the universe, made a commandment upon himself that his mercy would always prevail over his wrath. So God told himself that, yes, I will be more merciful. So even as a judge, God is going to be more compassionate than vengeful. And that is the principle. So even when we implement laws, we have to be compassionate. And I think ISIS has demonstrated that the way they would like to implement the laws are in the most brutal possible way. I mean, their beheadings, the imposition of the laws, the way they have essentially used capital punishment excessively, throwing people off buildings, shooting them. This is the most ugliest demonstration of Islam, even if it is technically, legalistically justifiable by certain theologians. So my argument is that this is not what God intended when God said that he sent Muhammad as compassionate, as merciful. In fact, in one tradition, Prophet Muhammad said, you are not a Muslim, you're not a Muslim, you're not a Muslim if your neighbor is afraid of you. So this idea that people are afraid of Islam and Muslims itself renders that un-Islamic from based on tradition. So my argument is, can I at least offer a way of thinking about having Muslims? I'm not asking Muslims to abandon Islam. I'm saying practice your faith, but practice it in the most beautiful way. don't ignore the beautiful aspects of the faith in pursuit of just law. That is not all of Islam. There's much more to Islam than just laws.
Well, let me ask you this, because one of the things that struck me is, and it's not an original idea, but that there is a suffusion, it seems, in Islam between the religion and the state. And when I think about, for instance, Christianity, you didn't get that fusion until Constantine, and even then there was a certain sort of separation of this church. The state was really using the church, and of course it fractures with the Reformation, and produces countries like the United States where they're separate. Is part of the problem this fusion of church and state, or the religion and state?
I don't see it as a problem. Mm-hmm. This is the absence of secularism in religion.
Right.
It depends on the founding father. Like, for example, Jesus, peace be upon him, was more like an undocumented worker today in America. That's how we would treat him, right? He was a refugee in Egypt, a migrant. He mm-hmm. was poor, marginalized. Even though he was a rabbi, he was not an orthodox. Like, he was seen as a rebel even in his own faith. So, but Muhammad, peace be upon him, finished his last 10 years as a ruler of Medina. And so, because whatever he said and did is also a source of Islamic law, his traditions, and because he ruled and governed and passed laws and fought battles, all of that reduced the so-called secular space in Islamic imagination. Everything is sacred. So for example, if you remember Ashcroft, who mm-hmm. became Attorney General, I was watching his confirmation, and he basically promised that he would keep his values at home, his beliefs, and he would implement Roe versus Wade, even though he didn't believe in it. And I was saying, how can we make him the most important policeman in this country when he's promising us that he will be a hypocrite every day, that what he does will not be consistent with what he believes? He should not take that job because the laws are, he should try to change the laws before he works. So for a Muslim, if there are values, God wants you to be honest. So you have to be honest in your workplace. You have to be honest when you are a ruler. You have to be in private or public. So Islamic values are not quarantined in the private sphere. And therefore, it's difficult to think of Muslims as secular individually. But as a country, what I am arguing is that the state need not be theological. It can be secular in the sense it can give people the freedom to be Muslim or not to be a Muslim. It should be your choice. The state should not force you to be a Muslim. So you can have a state which provides the freedom to be. And that's where true faith matters, because when you have freedom not to be a Muslim and you choose to be a Muslim, then your faith really matters. But if you are being a Muslim because you're afraid of being put in jail or being killed by the government, then what point is that faith? But Muslim groups should be willing to advocate for values. And I think it's very similar to the American model. You as a civil society institution are welcome to go out there and preach your faith and preach your values and even engage with politicians and say, this is the most beautiful way of doing. This is how we can solve our immigration problem. This is how we can solve all opioid problems or whatever. But they should not be forced by the state. That's my whole point. So in that sense, I do believe in a secular polity. But a polity which is not that excludes religion out of the public sphere, but does not privilege religion either.
How do you see then Islamic values being expressed through this state? That's, for instance, that many Muslims may very well feel very comfortable with, as opposed to this very sharp separation that we have here. I mean, it does seem as if Muslims want, in other countries, want to see their values, whatever it is, whether it's Sharia law, whether it's the Hadith, whatever it is, somehow expressed and seen through the government.
Take the United States, for example.
Yeah.
At the moment, there is nothing in American law or constitution that forces Muslims to do what Islam forbids. Okay, like for example, if Islam forbids me from consuming alcohol and eating pork, the American Constitution does not demand, the Chinese are demanding that Uyghurs should eat pork, but the US doesn't demand that I drink alcohol mm-hmm. or drink pork. So there's nothing in American law that forces me to violate Islamic laws and Islamic values. And the contrary is also true. Everything that Islam requires me to do, which is to fast in the month of Ramadan, pray, be honest, etc., none of that is forbidden in Islamic, in American law. So you can imagine a secular state dominated by non-Muslims, which is allowing Muslims to be Muslims, and also allowing Buddhists to be Buddhists and allowing Hindus to be Hindus. So that is, I think, the best model that humanity has discovered on our after thousands of years on this planet. And I think that is okay with me, and I think that is a desirable state. But what I'm arguing is that even this state can be violent. It can be national security obsessed,
sure,
for imperial, invading other societies. That is where values, Islamic values, can come in, and Muslim groups and other ethical groups can say, no, our priority is not global domination, but our priority is saving the planet, for example. We could take that as a... So that's where my discussion about thinking about national virtue rather than national interest comes in. So yes, you're welcome to practice Islamic law as long as you don't enforce that on others, but not make enforcing that law on others as the criteria for an Islamic society.
Well, let me ask you this. Is there a contrast between what we say, for instance, see Islam in the Middle East as opposed to, say, Islam in Asia, where there doesn't seem to be necessarily this fusion of church and state?
Well,
or is that a correct view? I mean, I don't...
There are culturally different types of manifestations. Like, for example, some scholars have tried to distinguish between Arab Islam and Persian Islam. So Persian society, or those societies influenced by Persian culture, have shown more proclivity towards aesthetics. For example, beautiful buildings, beautiful mosques, etc. There is lack of austerity and strictness, which is manifested in some of the Arab societies. For example, even in juristic schools within Islam, which the Arab ones are far more stricter than the ones which are there. And Sufi traditions have arisen on the periphery of the Arab world. So yes, there is a cultural difference across the world. Indonesian Islam is very different from Islam that is practiced in Senegal, for example. Pakistani Islam now varies significantly from Indian Muslims, and so on and so forth. So there are cultural manifestations, and I think that is okay, because urf or custom is an important part of Islamic law. Muslims do a lot of things that Arabs used to do before Islam, and it became part of Islamic tradition. The problem is that Islamic scholars are obsessed with this whole idea of Islamic law, that they deliberately do not educate Muslim masses on other sources, on other aspects of Islamic law, and they try to hide that. For example, ihsan is one of the most beautiful aspects of Islam, and in my book I show how even classical scholars have tried to hide it, because they didn't want people to become mystical. They wanted to be law-abiding, and, you know. So that is, there is this. And you can therefore see that you have a state like Pakistan, which with all its limitations is still democratic, as opposed to Saudi Arabia, and both say that they are Islamic republics. So you have an elected president in Pakistan, and you have a monarchy in Saudi Arabia. So yes, there is diversity in Islamic world. That tells me one thing, that there is no such thing as the Islamic. There's no the Islamic. There are many Islamic things, societies, cultures, and states. And I'm trying to say, among all of these, which is the most beautiful one, the one that privileges virtue over everything else.
Finally, a minute to where two we have left. One of the things that you offer up is this idea of serving Allah as serving other people. And I was reminded, as a matter of fact, I was talking to a former clergyman who suggested that the Good Samaritan story, as a matter of fact, is just about that, about how God looks upon the Good Samaritan as someone who serves somebody else. You emphasize that a lot.
So, for example, there is a Sufi saint in India called Nizamuddin Awliya, and he said the whole purpose of human existence and the purpose of Islam is to do what he used the word khidmat-e-khalq, service to humanity. So the in the definition of what is beautiful, what is ihsan, it is stated that ihsan is to worship God as if you see him. But the Arabic word worship also means service. It's the same word. to serve God as if you see him. And therefore, since you can't see God and you can't directly serve God, you can serve his creation. And therefore, service to humanity and is like worship to God. And that is the most, I think, thing that Muslims should focus on, and all people should. If you want to be a good person, the best way you can be a good person is by being helpful to others. My daughter once told me when she was a little young, she says, "I don't like your sermons because you tell people to be good to go to heaven." So I said, "Why do you help people?" She said, "I help people because they need help." And I realized that that was very beautiful.
We've been speaking with Professor Mukhtar Khan. He is with the Political Science Department at the University of Delaware. He's written a new book called Islam and Good Governance, a Political Philosophy of Islam. And I appreciate you stopping by and chatting with us this morning.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me, Don.
Thank you. This has been Del Mar Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening. There you go. The sounds of live classical music return to the Eastern Shore this August. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. Chamber music by the sea is coming back for a fourth summer with concerts set against the beauty of the Eastern Shore. They will be held in historic Berlin, as well as Snow Hill and South Point. Festival has a strong commitment to education involving young local musicians in both outreach activities and in the concerts themselves. Helena Urey-Oste is a renowned violinist and the event's artistic director. Delmarva Public Radio's Chris Rank sat down with the musician to learn about the festival.
All right, so let's begin. Let's start talking about this year's festival. So how many years have you been doing this now?
This is the fourth year of Chamber Music by the Sea. We started in, 2016, and the festival has grown little by little each year, expanding in number of musicians, number of venues, number of events, and it's just blossoming.
How did this idea begin in the first place?
I have been in love with this area, being the Berlin, Snow Hill, Assateague area, since I was about 17 years old. I first started coming down here with family friends, I believe in 2003, and just thought it was so beautiful, the bay and the ocean, obviously, and the town of Berlin. I just thought it was all so magical. But I noticed that there was a considerable lack of classical music, and just sort of tucked that observation away in my mind. A few years ago, talking with some friends, I had sort of had some pipe dream of beginning a music festival somewhere beautiful for a long time, basically as an excuse to hang out at a beach with my friends and play some chamber music and, commune with the locals. And one friend suggested to me, well, why don't you just do it where your parents are? My parents retired to Berlin a few years ago, but they've been traveling back and forth between here and Philadelphia since 2006. So they've been based here for a while. And this friend just said, well, obviously, just do it in Berlin.
How much time do the musician friends who come and play with you, how much time do they get to actually hang out in Ocean City in Berlin and do all the things that locals do?
Oh, I make sure there's plenty of free time integrated into the schedule because I want it to be a really enjoyable experience for everyone involved. Obviously, for the people who are attending the concerts, I want them to be exposed to the highest quality chamber music. But I want my friends and colleagues to have a really good time. So I try and block out each day so that there's a considerable chunk where they can go to the beach, explore town, anything, so that it doesn't feel like work. It feels like fun.
Well, that was the other question I have, is it sort of seems like an odd thing to do on your summer vacation. Like, hey, I'm on summer vacation. I'm going to go do a whole festival of work now. Is that hard? I don't know. Is that hard to do? Is it hard to get people motivated to want to do something in the summer? Is the summer usually the time when you don't do a lot?
Honestly, it's not hard at all. The summer festival season is quite a busy time for musicians. So if they weren't coming to this one, they'd be going to another one. So I like to snag them early. Personally, I would be probably performing anyway or hoping to be performing. And if I wasn't, I would probably be carving out some time to spend here. So for me, it's the perfect combination of work and play. And also personally, there came a point a few years ago where I was kind of tired of being beholden to other people for shaping my career, tired of waiting on presenters or managers or other people to say when I could and could not play. And so it feels incredibly empowering to start something from scratch, take matters into my own hands. And, you know, I don't view the festival as guaranteed employment for myself. It's not that at all. It's just molding something from the ground up that I don't have to really compromise on at all, and just to lay out a festival the way I would like it to be laid out.
When they're not actually performing, what are the festival musicians' favorite things to do?
Well, we are all big fans of the Burley Oak, so you can definitely catch us there, if not playing music, enjoying some flights of beers. Yeah, that has been a big hit in
classical
past
musicians
seasons.
Drink beer? I don't believe it.
Oh my gosh, do we ever? Yes, we are very well versed in the selection of IPAs over at Burley Oak. We have also been known to do some pop-up sets around town. So if you are near the Atlantic Hotel, I believe on Thursday, August 15th, you might be able to hear us there. Maybe it'll whet your appetite for the concerts after that. And yeah, you can probably find us at the beach more than once, exploring around Berlin or Snow Hill. But definitely keep your eyes peeled because we will be out and about.
When the musicians come, how do you pick the material that you're going to play? Is it, hey, I've been working on this. This is something I've always wanted to play. I've never gotten a chance to play it. Do you sit around as a committee and kind of figure out which pieces you're going to do? How does that work?
Well, I'm very lucky from the artistic director point of view in that this festival, I would say it's, we are so lucky to be under the umbrella of the Worcester County Education Foundation. They kind of sort a lot of the logistical things, help with fundraising. I mean, are totally responsible for the fundraising, which is amazing. They have nonprofit status, so we basically get to fold into them, and in return, all of the money that we raise as Chamber Music by the Sea goes towards benefiting the Worcester County Education Foundation. So it's an amazing symbiotic relationship, and we are so lucky for that. And in working together, they basically give me complete artistic control. So I get to decide what the music will be, who the musicians will be, what the format will be, which is such a gift. And with regard to the repertoire, kind of a combination of factors go into choosing it. This summer's particular program, which is largely French music, has sort of been test-driven in other combinations before. My fiancé, Tom Poster, who is also the pianist this year and has been for the last two summers, he is an absolutely incredibly gifted programmer. So he put together pretty much this assortment of pieces and combinations of musicians for other festivals in the UK. So I had the idea that it would be great to have available a pianist, a string quartet, a tenor, and a soprano, because we'd worked in that combination before elsewhere. So I kind of cobbled together something similar. So this year's Chamber Music by the Sea festival program is very much inspired by other iterations of this program that Tom organized. I like to give the musicians kind of a heads up, ask them whether there's anything they're dying to play, whether there are pieces that are in their fingers that they have to play at other festivals nearby. Again, so they don't feel like it's
extra
a
work.
Huge, exactly, a huge laborious process once we get here. I want it to be fun and as lighthearted as possible. Of course, taking the music making very seriously, but you know, not programming anything that's gonna shut us inside for days at a time and make us crazy.
Let's talk about some of the musicians who are coming back this year. The pianist, Tom Poster, is coming back.
Yes.
Also, violinist whose name I can't remember, but she's coming back.
Yes, Melissa White and Tom Poster are both coming back, and they're both, I refer to them both as my partners, but in very different senses. Tom obviously is more of a romantic relationship, although we are business partners in a sense. We play together all the time as violin and piano duo. We have an album out. We're releasing another one next spring. We just concertize and brainstorm creatively quite a lot. So he is my partner in that sense. And Melissa and I are business partners in another area of life, we together run a program called Intermission, which combines music and yoga, which I'm happy to talk about more in depth. And so she is my partner in another sense and one of my closest friends and a fabulous violinist. So I'm delighted to have her back. She lights up the room for sure.
And the soprano and the tenor who are coming.
Oh my gosh, I'm so excited to have these people coming to make music with us. Kira Duffy is someone I have admired and looked up to forever. She was at Marlborough the first year that I was there in 2010, I believe. And I just thought she was jaw-droppingly amazing. So I've sort of been dreaming of having her sing with us for a while, and she said yes, and I'm so delighted. And Kareem Suleiman, I also met the same year at Marlborough, also thought he was absolutely just spectacular. We have worked together a bit in the past few years, actually doing a version of this program in the UK a few times, and we agreed when we were doing that Kira would just be such an amazing fit for that French repertoire. Kareem just won a Grammy. They're both such superstars. I'm so honored that they are coming to Berlin to play with us.
So was it hard to get them? You just called them and said, hey, do you want to come to Berlin and play? And
they just said, sure. I think I texted both of them, said, are you free? Do you want to come have a beach vacation / play a lot of, sing a lot of amazing music? They were both like, yeah, sounds good. So it pays to have amazingly talented friends who also like the beach.
Are we forgetting anybody?
Yes, we've got two new string players coming on board. Caitlin Lynch, the violist, and Nathan Chan, cellist, both of whom I met at a festival I adore out in Winthrop, Washington, the Metau Valley Chamber Music Festival. I met them both there over the last few summers, and Caitlin is just one of the kindest, sweetest people I've ever met, and Nathan is absolutely hilarious and charismatic and quite a social media virtuoso as well. So you can check his stuff out online. And I both adored working with them. They just made the atmosphere so playful and enjoyable. So I'm very excited to have them on board. And then there's one other person I should mention, a student of mine named Hannelise Wang, who I first met in a masterclass here in Berlin a few summers ago. And she began playing for me privately here and there when we can make our schedules line up. And she is actually going to be joining us for one of the pieces in the August 16th Friday night concert here at Buckingham Presbyterian.
Oh, good. I'm glad you brought up the masterclasses, because are you going to be doing them again this year?
Yes, we have a full day of education activities this year, August 15th, that's the Thursday of that week at the Berlin Public Library. So we will have a family-friendly concert, which is something I'm very excited about. This is the first time we're doing that. It's really important to me that people of all ages, backgrounds, etc., be exposed to classical music and be able to experience it in a non-threatening way. So there are all these stigmas around classical music that you have to be quiet, that you have to know the rules, you can only clap.
Don't clap in between movements.
Exactly.
You're going to get in trouble.
That drives me bonkers. I hate it. So I wanted to build in a concert where kids could come primarily. It's being advertised as a family concert, but really people of all ages or levels of experience to come in a very relaxed environment. People can move, wiggle, clap, howl, whatever, just as long as they're there enjoying it. So that will be the morning of August 15th. And from the morning concert, we will transition into a masterclass for local young violinists in the area, many of whom I believe I will have worked with before, and hopefully some new players as well. And that will give a chance for people in the community to also see how a masterclass works. Again, that will be open to the public. I hope people come and are interested in that learning process, because it can be quite educational, not only for the players themselves, but for people who don't necessarily know how a lesson works.
So what happens in a masterclass? I've always heard about masterclasses, and I always thought, you know, this is just private time with a teacher, but what kinds of things will they be learning about?
Well, it depends on what they bring, what piece they bring, what their areas of focus are, what I observe as the quote-unquote teacher. But a masterclass is basically just a semi-public lesson. So it would be shorter than your average private lesson. But the students will play for me, and I'll try and give them, you know, within 15 or 20 minutes, some key points to to work on both in the session and then to take with them into their own practicing. My hope is that it's, you know, it can be quite nerve-wracking standing up in this setting that's sort of weirdly lodged between a lesson and a performance. So it can be unnerving. But my hope is that, you know, the people who do come to spectate will be supportive and that the students know that they're safe and in good hands and very much loved by the community. And then after the masterclass, we'll have a group rehearsal, again with local young musicians who are going to join the festival musicians for one piece in the Friday night concert at Buckingham Presbyterian Church. So that's always a cool opportunity for the students to learn from all of the festival musicians, get different perspectives, and play some chamber music.
So you just came from the yoga studio.
I did.
And if anybody has ever been to your website or ever heard about you, they know that you are all about yoga. So let's talk about that for a little while, because it may be something that is sometimes, I think, hard for some traditional classical music people to sort of wrap their heads around. What does yoga have to do with your playing, or how does it help it?
Everything. It has everything to do with playing. The place I would start is, as musicians, we spend so much time from the time we're very small, most of us, focusing on one area of our body, mm-hmm. namely the hands. Getting the hands to do what they need to do in order to produce a beautiful sound, play in tune. You know, if you're playing a wind instrument or piano, pressing the right keys at the right time, coordinating everything. So we think about our fingers and our hands, and maybe if we're being really smart, we think about maybe somewhere up to the elbow. But usually it stops there. And I'm sorry to say that much of music education has done us musicians a great disservice by not acknowledging that the body is one organism. It's one system. So whatever's going on in your lower back or your hips or your feet is absolutely going to affect what's going on in your hands. If your muscles are stiff or fatigued or cold, they will not perform optimally. If your posture is wonky, if your balance is off, all of these things affect how you are able to hold your instrument, how you're able to breathe. Then we have breathing. Obviously, wind and brass musicians and singers think about breathing a lot more consciously and intelligently. But string and pianists and percussionists, chances are we've not had one conversation with our teachers or colleagues about breathing and how it might positively or negatively affect our playing. So yoga, when I began practicing yoga, brought so many things about the body as a complete system to my attention that I'd never thought about before, such as balance, for example. When I began doing postures that required balancing on one leg, balancing on my left leg was a breeze. Balancing on my right leg was impossible. And I started thinking about why, and then I realized it was because I had favored one leg for all of the years that I'd played the violin. At that point, it was probably 18 years. So I had 18 years of strengthening my left leg and doing nothing on my right.
And that's in your stance.
Okay. In my stance, yeah. So I would kind of pop my left hip out, kind of like I was just hanging out at the mall, mm-hmm. And not engaging my right leg muscles at all. Breathing was very eye-opening. I'd never really thought about breathing consciously, about truly filling my lungs with air, about taking complete exhales so that I could then inhale. And then with regard to the violin, it had never occurred to me that if I didn't want my bow to shake, I should probably be breathing deeply and regularly. So I started playing around with coordinating inhaling and exhaling with my up bows and down bows. That was a huge eye opener. And then just the practice of devoting yourself to moving for 60 or 75 or 90 minutes on your mat, it really builds concentration. I think a lot of us musicians, you know, we're dedicated practicers, but we're not necessarily dedicated focusers. We spend a lot of time clocking hours in the practice room, not necessarily with our minds engaged to their fullest capabilities. So for instance, when I would be in a yoga class and I'd be instructed to hold a posture for a full minute, it seemed impossible. But gradually over time, I built strength and stamina and was able to do it. And when I was able to achieve that, I would say to myself, okay, Elena, if you can hold this incredibly difficult balancing stick posture for 60 seconds, you can get to the end of a passage in your concerto without, you know, your brain drifting off to somewhere. So focus was a huge element of it. And then the last thing I'll say, just because, again, I could talk about this for hours, something that yoga has really brought to light is the practice of self-compassion, which is something that it really breaks my heart, but most musicians have not installed that software in themselves. Again, I think music education is partly to blame. A lot of us are still kind of reeling from the effects of old school traditions, play through the pain, drill it 100 times if you mess up, doesn't matter if you're tired, if you're sore, like practice anyway, 4 more hours, blah, blah, blah. All of that is so insane and so unkind. And, you know, athletes would never treat themselves that way. They would push themselves, of course, develop discipline and strength and focus. But if they're injured, if they're tired, they know the importance of rest. And they know that pushing through that is only going to further set back their process. And it's just, it's not nice not to be nice to yourself sometimes. I think that building self-discipline is, of course, a huge part of the practice of becoming a musician or someone who's dedicated to anything, art, sports, life. But if you never pause to notice how you feel, offer yourself words of encouragement or kindness, and claim small victories, how sad. And I don't think that's what any composers or instrument makers or the people who invented music intended for music to be. I think music is meant to make the world better. And if we're all just abusing ourselves in order to share it with people, I think we're missing the point.
It seems like it's sad how many kids drop out of music because they become discouraged because I can't play this piece, I'm not good enough. And no matter how many times I try it, I just can't get it. And I've been trying to repeat it, and it's just not happening, and my fingers aren't working right. I give up.
Yeah. And all of those things may be true. I've certainly felt like that a lot of the time, and my incentive to keep going was just because I thought I had to or someone expected that. Actually, no, for me, it was always personally pretty self-driven. But there are moments when I look back upon where I definitely could have been a lot more patient and kind with myself. I could have taken a moment just to notice how I was feeling without attaching a story to it. Like everything you just said, we're attaching stories to a little mess up, quote unquote mess up. Whereas if we were just to observe what had happened, okay, that one note or that one passage didn't go how I wanted it to. And then funneling our energy into finding creative ways to improve that one thing rather than creating this whole story, I can't do it, I want to quit, I'm not good enough. Because that's all just sort of abuse of the mind that we've trained ourselves to do. I'll just share one anecdote about this. I just completed my 200-hour yoga teaching certification up at Kripalu in Massachusetts. And after our final practice teach where we taught little groups, we led them through a 60-minute yoga class. I thought I'd done okay, but my mentor, I spent the next half hour basically begging her to be mean to me because that's what I was used to. Like, tell me what I can do better. What sucked? Like, lay it on me. I can take it. And she refused to do that. She was very nice. But then afterwards, as I went into the hallway, I overheard another girl being asked about her experience doing her practice teach, and she just said, I felt amazing. And my knee-jerk reaction was, that was kind of cocky. But then I thought about it, and I was like, why shouldn't you feel amazing? You just did this amazing thing. You led 60 minutes of yoga. You helped other people feel better. You gave it your all. You deserve to feel amazing. I'm sure you were amazing. And in that moment, thousands of concerts flashed before my eyes, my own and my colleagues, my friends. Never once have I heard someone walk off stage or myself walk off stage and say, I felt amazing. Either admitting to it or allowing themselves to feel that and speak those words. And it broke my heart.
Let's go back to the festival for a little bit. Let's talk about the music in particular. Is there any highlights that we should be waiting for?
I kind of feel like every piece on this year's program is a highlight. So it will be difficult for me to...
It's like picking among your children.
Exactly. I truly love all of these pieces. So at our first house concert, we'll be playing the Ravel Trio, which I feel is just one of the most perfect pieces of music ever written. You might recognize it from the movie Birdman. sort of like now two niche references. But yes, it was very masterfully woven into Birdman. That's a favorite piece of mine. At the concert at All Hallows Episcopal Church in Snow Hill the next night, I really love the Fauré Trio. I think it's a very special work. He wrote it, Fauré wrote it when he was very nearly completely deaf. His deafness manifested itself in the form of him losing the high and low registers of his hearing. So a lot of the music is very condensed in the middle register. There's a lot of unison between the strings, which creates these very fascinating, sparse sound worlds. Kareem, the tenor, will join us that night for Fauré's La Bonne Chanson, which I think is magical. Let's see, the Friday night concert at Buckingham Presbyterian, one of my very favorite things to play, the Chanson concert. Tom will speak about that at the concert because he's got a really good spiel down. But it's an amazing work, so dynamic, for a very unusual combination of instruments. It's for violin, piano, and string quartet. And Chausson, who died very tragically in a bicycle accident, actually, he was a pupil of César Franck. So you can really hear Franck's influence in the music, and I will steal one of Tom's lines. It's as though, he was obviously very inspired by Franck's famous sonata for violin and piano. And Tom likes to say, it's as though the combination of violin and piano grew so intense that it birthed a string quartet. So that sort of gives maybe a weird idea of what that piece might offer. And also on that program, Kira, our soprano, will join us for a absolutely heartbreakingly beautiful piece by Messiaen, a very early work for another unusual combination of musicians, violin, piano, soprano, tenor. Like I said, it's very early in Messiaen's catalog of work. And it's just so beautiful. It ascends to the heavens, as many of my favorites of his pieces do. And then our final concert, our last Salon house concert in Berlin on the Saturday, will be a little more lighthearted, more Salon-y work, some really cool combinations, violin, piano, soprano, violin, piano, tenor. So it'll just be a really cool cross-section. We won't repeat any of the works. Oh, I completely forgot the first concert, which will be a recital, a violin and piano recital at Temple Bat Yam on August 11th. And that will be mostly French, but we'll deviate from a strict French theme at times. And that will be a joy. That will be our first concert in that venue, which has a beautiful piano, beautiful acoustics. So I'm very excited to add that into the mix.
Okay, so you're going to play a selection for us now. Yeah. Tell us about it.
So I have a little thing prepared. Tom Poster is an extraordinary pianist, of course, but he is also a very masterful arranger. So a few years back, I needed a birthday present for my dad, who had flown over to see us perform in Germany. And Tom said, well, what's his favorite song? And I blurted out, Over the Rainbow. So Tom arranged Somewhere Over the Rainbow for us, in the very interesting key selection, as he says, of B major. I just think it's one of the most beautiful arrangements of anything. I know I might be biased, but it really is quite pretty. I don't have Tom here with me, sadly, so I will just be playing the violin part, but I think it's pretty nonetheless.
Let's just get this out there. If anybody wants to know all the dates and times and where they can get tickets, the best place to go is?
Our website, and that is www.chambermusicbythesea.com. It has all event information, dates, times, locations. You can read more about the musicians, buy tickets. It will link you to the Worcester County Education Foundation's page. You can email us if there are any concerns or confusions. Everything should be right there. So we look forward to your visit.
Well, thank you very much for coming in.
Absolutely.
Elena Uriosti, renowned violinist and artistic director of the Chamber Music by the Sea, talking with Delmarva Public Radio's Chris Rank. Concerts will be held August 11th through the 17th. They are sponsored by the Worcester County Education Foundation. This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening.